Hey, podcast fans, this is Chris Webster, founder of the APN, and I just want to thank you for downloading this episode. Please consider becoming a member of the APN if you're not already, and helping us make more great shows and get them out to the world. Head over to arcpodnet.com/members or click the link in the show notes. On to the show.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Archaeology Show, episode 195.
On today's show, we talk about the Netflix series Ancient Apocalypse.
Let's dig a little deeper into Graham Hancock's web of lies. Welcome to the show, everyone. How's it going?
Pretty good. I think I'm still stuffed with turkey.
I know. For all of you that are not in the United States, we just recently celebrated Thanksgiving. And I don't know, for us, it's kind of like the best holiday of the year.
Yeah.
There's not a lot packed in it except for just family
just
and good
like,
food.
Yeah, just eating a lot of delicious food. It's the best.
So it's fun. And we're over here in Charlotte, North Carolina with Rachel's family.
Yep. Yeah. And we have a lot of really specific ideas around Thanksgiving and what we should be having. So it was good. It was good. There's a lot of family recipes involved and it was great.
You know what we're not giving thanks for?
Graham Hancock, perhaps?
Hey, trends in Netflix shows. So if you haven't seen it or if you don't have Netflix.
Or maybe you're boycotting it. And if you are, good for you.
Either way, the top Netflix has, depending on what app you're looking on and how you're engaging with Netflix, we use Apple TV. And most of them are similarly configured in some way or another. There's always a trending now, like a top 10 trending shows. Yeah. Usually it's stuff that like just came out because people want to see stuff and there's FOMO and they just want to do it. But not always.
And Netflix uses that algorithm to push the shows they want you to watch too, for sure. So
Sure. But the trending is not what they want you to watch. The trending is what's happening now, right? How many people are watching this and you know whether or not it's popular. So and then of course once it gets on the trending list, more people see it, more people watch it, it just perpetuates itself, which is terrible for certain shows. And one of those is Ancient Apocalypse. It's an 8-episode series by Graham Hancock, who is popular from the Chariots of the Gods book that he wrote decades ago, which basically promoted ancient aliens as the source of, or at least ancient technology. I'm not sure if he actually said ancient aliens in that, but ancient technology being the source of inspiration for basically everything that happened after the Ice Age. So, you know, agriculture and megalithic structures, pyramids, all kinds of stuff. These people couldn't possibly have come up with it on their own. They must have had help. And this was the help. So he's using this series to basically perpetuate that theory, but in a in what I feel like is a slightly new way as far as everybody finding this out. I mean, he's written many books about this and been vocal about it. So it's not new by any sense of the word. But it's new for the popular discourse in that his overarching theory here is that there was an ancient advanced civilization of humans that lived during the Ice Age. He doesn't have a theory, at least that he proposes on this show, of like when they started.
Very vague. The information about this ancient advanced civilization is super vague, just that it existed and that it passed its technology onto the prehistoric human cultures that we see around the world
around
today. Around the world. So
except Australia.
He didn't go to Australia, but he did. And not really South America either. He was in North America, Mexico, the United States, and then over in Europe and in Turkey. But in Indonesia, I think, as well. But anyway, he definitely picked and chose the sites that he wanted to show in as supporting his theory.
And let's be clear here. We're not saying don't go watch the show. It's not really going to do any good for us to say boycott this show. I mean, it's popular on Netflix. It's going to be popular on Netflix. There's enough people who aren't scientifically minded, who are not archaeologists, who are not, you know, students or fans of history and things like that, that are just going to watch it because it's in the top 10 on Netflix. They're going to start watching it. So like I said, we're not going to have any impact at all by saying don't watch it.
And like, I don't think that's a good idea anyway, because the worst thing that we can do as archaeologists and as people who are just interested in archaeology, depending on what your perspective is to shut down stuff like this. And when you shut it down, then you don't have the argument and the conversations that hopefully bring the true scientific theories to light rather than the pseudoscience, which is what he's proposing a lot of here.
Yes.
But we should talk about what we liked about the show. I mean, we didn't absolutely hate it, right? There were things to like about it.
I mean, like all, well, Netflix productions, but most modern productions.
Yeah.
There is a lot of really great computer graphics
there
in this.
There are. And the reconstructions of these sites are so cool and so well done.
Right.
You don't get that kind of stuff on like a History Channel show. I mean, kind of, but not to this level and not this good for sure.
Yeah, the visualizations of the geology that's happening, of the archaeology, like there's an episode, one of the later episodes that has Poverty Point in Louisiana on there. And one of the things, it's not Poverty Point, it's a Serpent Mound they're talking about. Mound. Yeah, it's in the same episode, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Serpent Mound in southern Ohio, that it is really difficult to see Serpent Mound because it's surrounded by trees.
Yeah.
And it's kind of in an arc shape.
Yeah.
And they strip away not only the trees around it, but they strip away the grass and stuff that's grown on Serpent Mound and just show it as a dirt structure.
Yeah.
As theoretically, you know, shortly after it would have been created, perhaps.
Right, yeah.
And what it would have looked like. Now, I don't know why there wouldn't have been any trees. I'm not really sure about that. Like what the environment was like. They didn't really get into that. But why wouldn't it have had trees around it?
Yeah, like this show, there's a lot of speculation. speculation about a lot of things throughout this show. And that was one of them.
That may not be speculation. That may just be something that was unspoken about, you know, in the show directly. Maybe it was edited out. But there could have been something about the paleo environment of that area that
there weren't a lot of trees.
Yeah, it was post-glacial. Things were changing, you know, or at least they say it was post-glacial and when it was created. Not to get too far into it, but current evidence puts that one, you know, a little over 1,000 to maybe 2,000 years old, but they take it all the way back to about 10,000 years old. So 10,000 years ago is when they would have done the reconstruction for, and there may not have been a lot of trees in this post-glacial environment.
Yeah, so, definitely. But either way, they made it so that through the graphics and the reconstruction, they made it so that you can get that visual of what it would have looked like so much better than if you just look at even aerial photographs of it today. So I really did like how they did that for all the sites that they visited. Yeah. It was really cool, really well done.
Yeah, and that leads to the other thing that's kind of that we liked and that's true about this. It's just it's hard to suss out really fact from fiction or speculation. And the thing we both noted was that it seems like, I mean, probably 80% to 90% of what's said in this series is real.
Yeah, they do a really good job of showing you the site, explaining what is the current accepted theory about the site, because archaeology is built on theories, because we don't know for sure what these people were doing and why. All we can do is theorize. And he does do a good job of presenting that before he goes off into crazy land and starts talking about, you know, ancient societies and floods and things like that, which we'll get into.
Yeah.
The other thing I really, really liked is that almost all the sites that they choose to focus on are not sites that are typically thought of in the mainstream media for archaeology. You know, there was no Stonehenge. They didn't focus on Stonehenge or the pyramids in Giza. They might have been mentioned in passing, but they weren't focused on. All these sites are like lesser known, and I love putting the spotlight on something that maybe people don't know a lot about, but it's still really cool and really worth knowing about. So I like that about the show as well.
Yeah, that's really cool. So, you know, and he does physically go to all these, to his credit. You know, there's very few.
Try to.
Right. Well, he went there.
Yeah.
Serpent Mound, they locked him out and wouldn't let him go.
Yeah, they wouldn't let him in. But
they let him in, but he wasn't allowed to film there.
Exactly. Yeah.
So they instead filmed adjacent to there and got drone footage. So,
yeah,
that was a little bit shady.
Probably a little shady, but
But anyway, they talked to the property owner that owns the property next to Serpent Mound. And this guy's the head of a group called Friends of... What is it? It's not Friends of Serpent Mound. It's like Friends of the Mound Builders or
something like that.
Yeah, because they support, I guess, preservation and historical interpretation of lots of mound sites.
But it sounded like a little bit more alternative theory rather than mainstream archaeology.
Sounded like they're at least
theories.
Open to it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But
not
way,
academic for sure.
Yeah. Either way, it's a group of interested people that are trying to, I guess, preserve these things. And there are people that go around buying up properties next to places like this for whatever reason, just to, I don't know what the reason is. I didn't get the impression the guy actually lives there. Maybe he does.
I didn't either. Yeah. And he didn't seem like it was like some old school farmer that had been there. Right. And his family had been there forever and ever. It was somebody who bought that property because they wanted to be near to Serpent Mountain. So, yeah.
So the biggest thing that our biggest takeaway, just to get this out in segment one, for those of you that may not listen to the whole show. The biggest thing that we caution in throughout this whole thing, and that we didn't, you know, I wouldn't say we didn't like, we weren't like offended by it, but it's the absolute dismissal of archaeologists in one breath, but then the acceptance of archaeological theory in another breath.
Yeah.
Like he'll say, archaeologists discovered decades ago or, you know, during an excavation that this happened. Great. Mm-hmm. He's accepting that.
Yeah.
But then he goes, archaeologists completely dismiss the idea and completely won't even think about adding this to their story.
Yeah, it's like he's totally okay with archaeology and archaeologists' methods. When it suits his theories, but he's completely dismissive of the theories and conclusions that come from the excavation. So you can't have one without the other. And I don't know. It just felt like an attack on archaeologists all throughout the show. It was it just the whole time, just archaeologists dismiss this. Archaeologists don't like this. And it's like, there's not that many feelings from archaeologists about theories. It's like there's evidence and there's not evidence. And you try to fall on the side of what there's evidence for.
Yeah. He says throughout that archaeologists refuse to do this and archaeologists refuse to accept that. First off. Yeah. He's lumping all archaeologists in together as a group of people.
Right.
Which is not true.
Not true. There's actually a lot of arguments amongst the archaeological community about lots of things.
There probably are individual archaeologists that refuse to accept certain theories.
Mm-hmm.
There's fights amongst well-qualified archaeologists about current theories today.
Yeah.
They don't agree.
It's debate. It's healthy debate about all of these different theories, and it will be. That's just how it is in academic communities. So there is always going to be argument and disagreement. There's not one body maybe there is kind of one body who disagrees with Graham Hancock. Yeah. But yeah. And
along these lines, you know, archaeologists have, he says throughout that archaeologists have, stuck to their narrative. He always says the narrative of history, this one story. In fact, in the last episode, he brings back on Joe Rogan, who the interview he did with Joe Rogan a few years ago is segmented on, I think, episode one.
Yeah.
And you see clips from that. But Joe Rogan actually comes onto the show in the last episode, which I don't know, like, who the actual hell is Joe Rogan?
I know. Like, why would he have anything to add to this conversation at all?
The sheer crazy that Joe Rogan has had on his show should tell you that he doesn't lend any credibility to this show.
No, he will entertain any theory about anything.
Right.
So you shouldn't believe anything that
and
guy
he's
says.
Probably doing it while he's high. So
could be. Yeah.
Anyway, the thing that he says is, you know, archaeologists are sticking to this narrative and they refuse to budge from this established narrative. And again, like I said, that might be true for some archaeologists. Mm-hmm. Archaeologists build their careers.
They do.
Especially older ones. On certain theories, and it's really difficult for them to come away from these theories of the line of evidence that they've accepted. But, you know, the thing is, if you look just back through archaeological textbooks and current thinking in archaeology, things change all the time.
They
We find new things, we come up with new dating techniques to redate old sites, to reinterpret older sites, things that have been found. And one thing Graham Hancock points out, which I totally believe him in, is don't always believe the signpost that's at an archaeological site or a roadside attraction, because those things do not change very often.
That could very much be out of date.
Those are very out of date. It takes like state funding to change them. Mm-hmm. And it's not going to happen when, you know, a new paper comes out that says, oh, now we believe this. Nobody's going to go say we have to go change the sign. Mm-hmm. The only place that might be true is national parks.
Yeah.
You know, national, maybe even state parks. But the like roadside attractions and the privately owned, privately maintained places like Serpent Mound and stuff like that is, you know, probably not going to change anytime soon.
Mm-hmm.
Unless they just go out there.
Need a lot of evidence to change whatever the current theory is about why something is the way it is. So for sure.
Let's take a break. And on the other side, we're going to come back and talk about some of the episodes and some of the stuff in the episode. So we'll do that on the other side back in a minute. It's Chris Webster again. If you haven't checked out our new parent website, culturomedia.com, then please do. Culturo is spelled KULTURO, and it's where we promote all of our live events. We've got one coming up in November. Check it out over at Cultura when it gets posted. If it's already happened and you're hearing this, then as a member, you can go to your member pages and see the event recording. Our live events are always free, but you have to show up during the event to see it. So that's culturomedia.com for all our live events and more. culturomedia.com. Chris Webster here, founder of the APN and host of several shows. I just wanted to let you know about our membership program and what it offers. Members of the APN get, for just $7.99 a month, or cheaper if you pay for the year, ad-free episodes so you don't have to listen to me on the breaks, membership in our Slack team so you can continue the conversation with hosts and other members, and exclusive access to any of our live event recordings. Live events are always free, but you only get to watch the recording if you're a member. So head over to arcpodnet.com/members for more info and to become a member. Our podcasts are always free, but this is just a little something extra and it really helps us out. That's arcpodnet.com/members. This is Chris Webster with the APN. I'm also a project manager for several industries. I wouldn't be able to keep on track with really anything if it wasn't for Motion. With Motion, I just say what I need to do, how long I think it will take, what sort of priority I think it has, and Motion builds my day for me. It'll even build in breaks because, let's be honest, it's hard to remember to stop to eat lunch sometimes. So head over to arcpodnet.com/motion for a free trial and a discount if you sign up. You'll kick back a small amount to the APN if you do. That's arcpodnet.com/motion. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 195, the Ancient Apocalypse Edition. And we're going to talk now, you know, we took some notes as we were going throughout, just some things that were said, some things about some of these episodes. The point of this episode is not necessarily to, you know, tell you the real history behind all these. That would really, really take more than one episode for every single one of these sites.
Yeah, every site is well documented and could be its own episode or at least segment of our show. Right. So we didn't do that kind of deep dive research on these sites.
Right.
We could maybe in the future, but we didn't do that for this episode.
But like
today.
I said, it would be at least one episode for every site of really intense research. And our point is to just kind of get the word out about this series.
Yeah.
And why you should be skeptical about some of the claims within it.
Mm-hmm. Totally. So,
anyway, one of the things he definitely does say in episode one is talking about North American prehistory. And this is really just kind of an old trope that is changing quite a bit. But, you know, when you look at pre-Clovis sites, and Clovis was for a really long time thought of as the oldest civilization across North America and possibly even South America.
Mm-hmm.
And because and it's all based on this one projectile point that was found that is very unique, very stylistically, again, unique and uniform across the continent.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a lot to say about that, too. But it's very unique and uniform across the continent. And it's found at similar depths and similar ages across the continent as well. And it came to be known as the Clovis culture because of where it was found in Clovis, New Mexico, the first time. Mm-hmm. The site was called Blackwater Draw. And that's where the first Clovis point was found and named.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that was back like, I don't even know when. Mm-hmm. Was it the 30s? Was it that early?
It might have been.
Maybe,
yeah.
I don't know.
It was a long time ago.
It was a long time ago.
Yeah.
But anyway, similar points have been found across the continent. And so they're like, well, this is like the oldest culture that we know of. But since then, and it took a long time for archaeologists to really accept this. But since then, other stuff has been found that dates to before that. And I don't have this in front of me, so I'm going off my memory, but I'm pretty sure like even in like Nevada, the Great Basin, the Western STEM tradition, I think predates Clovis.
I think in some cases it might. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's other stuff across the continent now that predate Clovis. Now you've got other sites too with slightly less solid claims that predate Clovis by a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, going back at least 20,000 years, from really solid stuff going back about 14,000.
Mm-hmm.
Clovis was around 10 to 12,000 years ago. But going back even farther than that, we've got sites in Oregon that were 14,000.
Mm-hmm.
We've got other stuff. And those are becoming, well, more accepted.
Mm-hmm.
But then you've got stuff that's like 20,000, 30,000.
Yeah, which we talked about not too long ago, like the footprints.
New Mexico.
Yeah, the footprints in New Mexico. I think it was White Sands,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, White Sands.
Yeah, they're pretty like well dated to like 20 to 22,000 years ago or something like that. So, I mean, the dates are getting pushed back. And I think this is one of the things that Graham Hancock says in the series is that archaeologists are unwilling to accept the evidence of pre-Clovis and pre-Ice Age, I guess, societies and civilizations. And it's like, yeah, 20 years ago, that would have been accurate. Because I remember in college.
10 years ago, that would have been accurate.
Yeah, totally. And I remember in college that like it was taught as this like fringe theory that there was very little evidence of, and like to be very careful of archaeologists that were, you know, pushing that idea forward. But actually, it turns out that it does seem to be true. And I think most archaeologists today accept that there was older than Clovis stuff going on in North America. So it happens. The change happens. It just, you need a lot of evidence. And honestly, maybe you need the old guard to you know, kind of fade away a little bit too, and newer archaeologists to come in and accept it. And so,
this goes back to just basic science too. It's, you've got this idea that's written in the textbook and people are taught this idea. Mm-hmm. And then a new thing comes around. You can't just rewrite the textbooks because of the new thing.
Yeah.
Because you don't know if this is a new one-off kind of thing, depending on where it was found. I mean, it should be noted that a lot of these really old sites are found in coastal areas. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you don't hear this theory talked about too much, but there's nothing saying that people didn't periodically end up in North America. It just wasn't the ones that stuck.
Yeah.
You know, the people that came here, stayed here and you know, populated and then survived. And then just, you know, I'm not saying there was like a North American Adam and Eve, but there were cultures that came here at certain times, possibly multiple times, and then kind of met in the middle sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know, there could have been multiple migrations in. There didn't necessarily have to be one migration into North America. And of those multiple migrations, some of them may not have lasted.
Yeah, they might not have made it.
There may have been somebody that got here 130,000 years ago and butchered a mastodon in San Diego. You know, I'm not saying that there's a lot of good evidence for that, but I'm also saying that that's not impossible. Mm-hmm. It is not impossible. And maybe they just didn't make it. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe the Ice Age killed them off. Who knows? But maybe for whatever reason, they got here and didn't make it. There were boatloads of people that came from England and Spain and France that also died when they got here. Mm-hmm. Completely wiped out.
Well, we have a really great example in the Vikings. We know for sure that they made it here and
didn't make it. Danish?
Didn't make it.
No.
They didn't, you know, they went back, they didn't make it. So,
yeah,
you know, it's definitely possible. There's just not a lot of evidence for it. So when you don't have evidence, it's hard to build a theory on it.
But it is accepted that the Vikings got here.
That one is, yes, that is accepted. That's for sure. It's the other things like the Cerruti Mastodon site that you mentioned, like that. There's just not a lot of evidence for it. And when you don't have the evidence, it's hard to have a theory. But Graham Hancock excels at creating a theory without a lot of evidence.
He lives in the spaces where it's like, well, maybe this could have happened.
Yeah.
And he accepts that what he's trying to do is he came up with this. He probably had this thought a long time ago. And trust me, I'm one of the first people that would jump on the bandwagon to say, I'd love this to be true because I love the thought of, you know, I love the thought of like an ancient technologically advanced civilization. I love the thought of ancient aliens. You know why? Mm-hmm. Because it proves that aliens exist.
It would be cool.
I would love to know right now that aliens exist, you know, and if they did, I mean, there's nothing saying that if there's other beings that are technologically advanced and spacefaring in this galaxy that we live in, it's unlikely that either A, they could actually get here. A lot of astronomers say that because they'd have to have a technology we can't even conceive of to just get here in time. But also, they could have already died out or they could be just developing now. Right. But there could have been multiple spacefaring civilizations that lived and died and are now extinct over the last billions of years, 14 billion years.
You just want Star Trek to be true.
I'm just saying.
You want the Vulcans to show up and like, you know, induct us into the Federation.
But see, that's the whole premise of Star Trek is actually flawed because these humanoid beings getting to the spacefaring stage of reality within the same 1,000 year span is so unlikely.
Oh yeah, totally.
Yeah, it's so unlikely. Yeah. Yeah. Very. Why not a billion years ago Star Trek could have been true? I more believe Battlestar Galactica, where they had spacefaring civilizations 200,000 years ago from our timeline. Mm-hmm. You know? So anyway.
Yeah.
Point is I'd love all that to be true. And what Graham Hancock does is he says, I believe this to be true, not I know it to be true. I believe this to be true. And then he tries to take every single thing and say, this fits my theory because of this one little aspect of it.
Yeah. Right?
And it's like the thing where it says, you know, if all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Mm-hmm. Right. If that's your only tool.
Yeah.
And it's crazy.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, if he would just say, well, you know, this is there's a low probability, but this could be true. But he looks at all these sites and then puts all this information together and says, this must be the reason for it.
Yeah. Like an example of that is in episode 2 in Cholula, Mexico. He is looking at this pyramid there. I think he looked at a couple places in Mexico and they all have these pyramid structures, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's pyramids in Egypt and in many other places around the world. Pyramid is the structure, a shape that exists in so many different places. And he's like, cool, that must have come from a lost older parent civilization, because otherwise how could all of these different people have independently come up with the shape?
Right.
And we know that that did happen in so many ways across the world with different, not just pyramids, but all kinds of different technologies were developed independently. But Graham Hancock doesn't want that to have happened independently. It fits his theory for them to have come from somebody before them who passed that knowledge on to them. And because he wants it to be that way, he just presents it as the like actual scientific evidence for his theory.
Right.
It's not true.
No. And one of the things he says in that episode as well was that we wrote down was, perhaps what's sadly lacking in archaeology is an archaeology of ideas.
You didn't do it with a British accent.
I can't. That was my British accent.
Was that your British accent?
Yeah, that was it. So, yeah, it's...
and he's so earnest when he says it, too. Yeah. Like he's trying to help us with, like, our ideas. We just don't have them. Yeah. I'm not going to say the next thing I wrote in my notes, Rachel, but I was pretty upset about that quote. I didn't like it very much.
I'll censor it just a little bit, but Rachel literally wrote down F right off Graham Hancock.
did I say Graham or did I say garbage?
Oh, garbage Hancock. Right. Nice. Gotcha.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I was trying to rein in my anger because I really don't want this episode to be just like a slamming Graham Hancock over and over again, because that doesn't do anybody any good. No. We need to take what he said and like really dissect it into pieces and look at what he's trying to say and just debunk it piece by piece rather than just slamming him as a human, because that doesn't help anybody.
Yeah. Another thing he mentions in this episode is the civilizing hero that he mentions, which he actually brings around. What he does throughout all these episodes, and he brings it together in the final episodes, is actually a kind of a masterful piece of writing.
It really was. Yeah.
Is he doesn't tell you he's doing this, which is great because it makes you think, oh, my God, I've got this revelation. And you're watching episode 8. Mm-hmm. But he talks about. He brings up in different ways the same ideas at all these different sites, which of course is the foundation of his theory, is that all these people were given this information. It was inherited knowledge, and it's the same inherited knowledge across the planet. But one of the common facets of this, and if you're watching this for the first time after listening to this show, look for this, because he doesn't exactly say it every time.
He doesn't. He builds the theory as he goes, for sure.
Right.
Yeah.
But in each one, there's the same idea that in their creation or founding myths, that a person or god or giant or some sort of fantastical entity shows up at some point after a catastrophe and says, here's how you rebuild civilization.
Yeah. He calls them the civilizing hero.
Yeah.
And this person... or this god or whatever, in the case of Cholula in Mexico, it was Quetzalcoatl, who's the feathered serpent. Yeah. He showed up in a boat with this knowledge of how to build monumental structures, basically, and how to progress their society after this catastrophic event happened, which is another thing he builds throughout the series, is the whole catastrophic flood event thing. He keeps bringing up these myths of floods, which there are so many of them throughout history.
Right.
All civilizations have flood myths. And I can only imagine it's because they lived near rivers and flooding was a thing. And one small river flooding would have felt catastrophic to them. So, you know, legends get built around that, right?
That's true. And depending on where these places exist, and a lot of them do exist, this is why there's nothing from the southern half of the globe in this, because the Ice Age didn't really impact the southern half of the globe in the way that it impacted the northern half.
True. Yeah.
So that's why none of the structures that support his theory are actually south of the equator.
That is such a good point. I didn't even realize that. That's totally true.
and again, the reason for that is these flood myths could be perpetuated by the chaotic melting of the ice caps, or not the ice caps, the ice sheets that were on North America and Europe during this time. And
created a lot of water.
When that melting happened, it created these big inland seas, these big lakes. It created, you know, outflow events that were catastrophic. It created all these kinds of things. And these you know, rightly so, these people living at that time, which we know there were people living at that time, they would have really had to deal with that.
Yeah.
And they'd have to come up with reasons for why this happened. And it's just like, you know, your popular ancient Greek and Roman myths where, you know, my fields aren't going to grow very well unless I pray to Zeus. And if I don't, I'm not going to get the rain, you know, and maybe if Zeus gets really mad, though, he's going to send lightning too.
Yeah.
You know, Zeus is known for lightning. I mean, it's just well known, you know, and these mythologies and these religions are built out of this nature and agricultural way of life because they just didn't understand a lot about what was going around them and how and why things were happening. And so they came up with these myths and these theories to explain that. Same thing Grant Hancock has done.
Yeah,
so
definitely. Oh, it is. It's like,
yeah,
it's exactly like that.
Yeah. He doesn't understand it. So he's come up with this fantastical reason for it.
Yeah. Creating his own mythology.
This isn't trying to disparage any sort of religion, but all religions are based on the fact that you don't know how something happens, therefore ... deity, right? And we've kind of distilled it all down to the one remaining thing that is we don't know a lot of how things happen, but the one big thing we still don't really understand is death. We don't want to understand it, we're afraid of it, and it's the absolute basis for every single religion on the planet right now is when you die, you're going here.
Yeah.
And we don't want to think that when we die, we're not going anywhere.
Yeah.
That is scary and frightening to think that you lived your whole entire life, or that your parent just died, or your kid just died, or your dog just died.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to fathom that they're just done.
Yeah.
So we invent this thing to say that they're afterlife. Not done.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what Graham Hancock is doing right here, is he's inventing this thing that fits his theory because he doesn't like where everything else came from. He doesn't like how it happened.
Yep.
So anyway, there's a lot of other stuff to talk about in these episodes, and we're going to get to some of that in this probably slightly longer segment 3, and then our sum up theories of or ideas, I guess, of this whole series. So back in a minute. Hey, fans of APN Podcasts, we've got lots of designs over at our Tee Public store. Every purchase helps out the APN with a few cents back to us. Check out the high-quality t-shirts, stickers, phone cases, coffee mugs, and a lot more. There are lots of colors to choose from in most of those items, and Tee Public often runs 30% discounts. So check out the store at arcpodnet.com/shop. That's arcpodnet.com/shop, and click on the link. Welcome back to the Idiotic Ideas Show, episode 194. It's not even episode 194. It's episode 195.
It is.
That's how idiotic.
Wow.
Yeah. That's how idiotic
it's literally written right in front of you.
In multiple places. I was looking right at it and I said 194. Anyway, 195.
Yep, 195.
And we're talking about the series Ancient Apocalypse, currently, unfortunately, popular on Netflix because not enough of you listeners right now are sharing these episodes to your friends and family.
Yeah.
So they can hear this stuff and then not watch that on, you know.
Yeah. I will say, though, I did a quick search on Google just to see like what the world is saying about the show, not what Netflix is saying about it. And all the top articles are like, is this like what?
Yeah.
Is this the worst thing on Netflix ever? Yeah. Yes, it is. So
but that just
there's
makes
a lot of criticism.
And it makes it more popular.
That's true. It does make people watch it. I'm still okay with people watching it, though, because there's good information in there. Yeah. You just have to be really, really skeptical of the conclusions that are being drawn.
Yeah.
Especially about things related to ancient myths.
Right.
And ancient lost civilizations that we have no evidence for, and archaeoastronomy.
Right.
So speaking of archaeoastronomy.
Speaking of episode 3 and a bunch of episodes after that.
Yes.
Really talk about archaeoastronomy.
They do.
And episode 3 is about Malta and
Giganta.
Yeah. Malta is a small island off the coast of Sicily and which is off Italy.
Yep.
And like a lot of places, first off, a lot of these coastal areas were walkable, like you could get to them pretty easily, like all of Indonesia, you know, all that stuff was walkable because during the last ice age and close to the end of the last ice age, a lot of these places, you know, the sea levels were 100 to 200 feet lower, if not more in some places.
Yeah, they were peninsulas, not islands, basically. Yeah. So people were easily able to get there.
They were mountaintops, you know, stuff like that. So anyway, so access to these was easier than it is now. And there are these huge megalithic structures on a site called Gigantia on Malta. And it dates to, they say, around 7,000 years old using the relative dating of artifacts. Now, Graham Hancock thinks that, you know, these are actually much older.
Yeah.
And those artifacts were just dropped there by later civilizations, which actually, I think, could actually be true in some cases.
It could be, you know? But like, he didn't discuss the context of the artifacts at all in the episode. So like, context is really key when you're using that as your dating method. You need to know where they were found, and the geological context is actually really important. And he doesn't talk about that at all.
But like, here's the thing. You do have to realize, and by you, I mean people listening to this, have to realize that, you know, in archaeology, you really just... You can't always assume that things are in association with each other. You can with a, like a buried site. That's usually, okay, you know, we're going to say that this old buried site that's really just hearths, a few hearths and some projectile points, those are more than likely all associated with each other. So if you can date the hearth through carbon dating or other means, then you can more than likely date the stuff around it. And when we start assembling those pieces of evidence across the world, then we generally know them to be true, right? But if you have a megalithic structure... Like, let's say Stonehenge, right? Stonehenge has been around for 5,000 years plus. There are people every year that visit Stonehenge. There are millions of people every year that visit Stonehenge. Who knows what they're dropping on the ground?
Now,
the people who manage it clean it up. But, you know, back in the day, that wasn't so easy, and it wasn't done all the time. So there's different cultures and different things that visit these structures that are very obvious and very visible on the landscape.
Yeah, and they would have been used by later peoples also, probably. So, it is valid to say that, you know, it could have been dropped by a later culture. But if the oldest thing that you're finding is 7,000 years and the artifacts also date to that, then like, it's a pretty solid idea that that is the oldest occupation of that site. They are the ones who created that site. But
yeah, if all of our civilization was wiped out today and then somebody 100 years from now descended upon the planet and said, look at all these things. And they went to the Empire State Building and saw that there were, you know, flat screen modern computers in the Empire State Building, internet wired throughout, and they knew that internet didn't become ubiquitous in this country until like the 90s. Then they might think that the Empire State Building was built in the 1990s because look what it's wired for. Look what it has. It's got all these modern things. When in reality, the Empire State Building was built in the 30s.
Yeah.
And they would have to dig deep into the structure of it to see
to find that,
you know, could possibly be true.
Yeah.
You know, so looking at stuff like, you know, Göbekli Tepe was eventually buried. Malta was eventually buried just through time. Although Malta, I think they said, was intentionally buried.
Yeah, it looks like some of it was potentially. Yeah. But
the point is, these structures were around for potentially thousands of years and other people could have dropped stuff there. So that's not wrong.
Yeah.
But he points out with Malta, going back to archaeoastronomy, that the orientations of these structures point towards the star Sirius. And the star Sirius's orientation, because of the movement of our solar system in the galaxy, has actually changed position. It's continuously moving, and not perceptibly, but over periods of thousands of years, it's moving.
Yeah.
And the orientation of these structures move to orient themselves towards Sirius.
Yeah. That just feels like a bit of a stretch as far as theories go, though.
I don't know. It could be true.
It could be. But like, the researcher, so he had on a researcher who was talking about this specifically, and she was saying that she systematically went through all the stars until she found one that all of them could have been oriented to. And I'm like, that just feels like you're really forcing you're looking at to fit the theory that you want it to fit.
You might think that because there's lots of stars, but Sirius in the prehistoric night sky, and if you've ever been
really
to
bright,
if you've ever been to a dark sky environment, Sirius is one of the brightest stars in the sky.
Yeah.
So it's prominent.
It's possible that this is accurate, but I just think that the orientation, the way they are, there could have been another reason for why all these structures are oriented in many different directions. And so, again, I like with theory, you can theorize, but you can't say for sure that that's what's going on.
The problem with this, though, is that Graham Hancock says throughout the remainder of the series that archaeologists choose to ignore the astronomical evidence. He even says during the Poverty Point Serpent Mound episode, which I think was 6 or 7, that archaeologists are not trained in astronomy. They don't understand astronomy. That is such a bullshit thing to say.
It is. Because it's so wrong.
Archaeologists aren't also necessarily trained in geology. We're not trained in nuclear physics, yet we use carbon dating.
Yeah.
We're not trained in all these kinds of things. We're trained in theory, archaeological theory. We're trained in archaeological methods. And once you become an archaeologist, if you do not embrace these other disciplines and bring in these specialists. Mm-hmm. We've worked on almost every single excavation we've worked on together. There have been geologists, people with like paleoethnobotany mm-hmm. and biology and all these different specialists that come in and they bring these ideas because yeah. you're right. People aren't cross-trained a lot. You know, your primary discipline includes a lot of theory in your primary discipline, but you have to bring in these specialists.
Yeah.
When I worked in Olivet Gorge in Africa, there's a project that I think might even still be ongoing. I'm not really sure, but it was run by Rutgers University called the OLAP Project. Mm-hmm. It was the Olivet Landscape Paleoanthropology Project. And what they were trying to do was look at slices of time and not just look at the human and hominid prehistory of that of the depth, but they were looking at the linear landscape mm-hmm. and what was going on in total. And they had, you know, PhDs and grad students from 10, 15 different disciplines mm-hmm. looking at this stuff.
Yeah.
Because no one paleoanthropologist, which is basically a, you know, a paleoarchaeologist, mm-hmm. no one person could know all these things.
Right.
So we're constantly bringing all this stuff. Now, despite all that, there's an entire field called archaeoastronomy.
There is.
Archaeologists yeah. looking for astronomical alignments and yeah. evidence on the Earth in archaeological yeah, sites.
It, absolutely. It's yeah. it's just ridiculous to say that archaeologists are dismissing this entire sub-discipline of archaeology. Like it's yeah. it's a thing and it's there. And when it's not being assigned or used on a site, it's probably because the evidence isn't there for mm-hmm. it. There's not a lot of evidence that there was a heavy focus on astronomy at that site, and that's why it's not being included. So but to say that we just dismiss it, like, that's absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah.
And speaking of things that archaeologists dismiss, we're going to just gloss over this really quickly because it's almost not even worth talking about. But episode 4 is about the Bimini Road and Atlantis. And this is a supposedly man-made road that is under the sea in Bimini.
Yeah.
Or off the coast of Bimini. And it looks really compelling when you look at it. It looks like there are parallel like lines of stone that are a road, mm-hmm. but it's been fully debunked by researchers in the 80s. There was a published paper on how it's not actually a road. And oh man, he's yeah, talking about it being Atlantis, and it's just
right. And they get these divers to go over there to look at it. Not geologists.
No.
You know, they're divers. And they have side-scanning sonar and they put detailed maps. Mm-hmm. And these guys just can't possibly conceive of the fact that nature could create these blocks of uniform size.
Yeah.
You know, it's not very probable around the planet. It doesn't happen all the time.
It doesn't happen a lot. But
then you look at like the Giant's Causeway in, I think it's Ireland. And mm-hmm. you look at Devil's Postpile.
Oh, Devil's Postpile. Yeah. Or in California. Yeah. By down, Mammoth, I think.
We've been there. It's yeah. down Highway 395. Yeah. It's yeah. by Mammoth. Mm-hmm. You look at these things and there's this. And even in episode 1 of Graham Hancock's series, there's these hexagonal basalt formations yeah. mm-hmm. and they build this structure out of them. And modern people are still building structures out mm-hmm. of these things. They're these columnar basalt, it's called. Mm-hmm. They're hexagonal in shape, but nature's creating perfect hexagons. Mm-hmm. How is it doing that? How yeah. could that possibly be?
Yeah.
You know, what about the giant quartz crystals that are found in caves in, I think, South America and other places, you know, deep down below the Earth's crust, these massive quartz crystals that are of uniform size mm-hmm. and shape. Nature is fully capable of producing precise geometry. Yeah,
it happens.
Yeah.
Not all the time, but it definitely happens.
Definitely possible.
Yeah.
And the only his only reason for bringing this entire Atlantis Bimini Road thing in is, well, A, to help promote the theory of Atlantis, yeah. which was supposed to be an advanced civilization that was buried by water. Although mm-hmm. It's the only time he brings up Atlantis throughout the whole thing.
Yeah, he talks about it a couple times, but he wasn't really focusing on it in this series. Yeah.
And again, the only reason he brings this up is because, you know, nobody could have possibly had roads 10,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is evidence that it was inherited information.
Yeah. And he also is talking about how archaeologists not dismiss, but aren't putting enough effort into looking for underwater sites yeah. too, I think is part of what he's talking about here, because this is definitely fully underwater. And again,
whole discipline of underwater archaeology.
Whole discipline. It's just hard, right? It's yeah. hard to excavate underwater. It's hard to do it. So,
well, the qualifications of being able to dive and do that are yeah, pretty steep.
It's just a lot. So there's not yeah. as much research going on because yeah. it's hard. So, yeah, but there's no dismissal of it, though. Graham Hancock, we're not dismissing anything. We know that the seas have been rising for the last mm-hmm. 10, 15,000 years, and that there's plenty of archaeological sites under the water. We can't get to them.
There's a number of sites in Turkey that he talks about. Mm-hmm. One of them is a now famous site of Göbekli Tepe. And it's an 11,000-year-old site that, again, has some very unique geometry to it. There's these standing T-shaped stones that, mm-hmm. you know, have some stuff on them. There's imageries of, again, serpents, which we mentioned before, carved into the stone. But a lot of the same ideas he's bringing throughout these different episodes is that this stuff, like he basically says they weren't doing this kind of monumental megalithic architecture previous to the Ice Age. They may have been doing it during the Ice Age, but we don't have evidence of it because there was ice everywhere. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly at the end of the Ice Age, all this stuff happens. Mm-hmm. They're able to build these things. And in this area of Turkey, when you're close to the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, which join up to dump into the Red Sea, mm-hmm. the Red Sea, I don't know, somewhere mm-hmm. around there.
Yeah.
This is what's known as the Fertile Crescent because of these two rivers and their annual floodings and all that stuff. It was a very fertile area. And that's where it's commonly believed that agriculture was first basically developed mm-hmm. in the world. Now, it was independently developed in other places as well, mm-hmm. but not earlier than that.
Right.
So you've got agriculture developed right there. And all of a sudden, he literally says, all of a sudden, agriculture, monumental design. Mm-hmm. And the only reason that could have happened is because it was inherited knowledge. They were taught that. They were taught how to grow things. They were taught how to build these things.
Yeah.
And yet, with all their carving, with all of their monumental architecture, and all these like, oh, I saw a comet, so I'm going to draw snakes all over the rocks. Mm-hmm. You know, with all of their symbolism and trying to explain what they don't understand on the rocks, why didn't they ever depict the ancient civilization that gave them this information? They would have revered them as gods.
Yeah, totally. That's a very good point.
But they never do that.
They never do that.
That's not Mm-mm. discussed once in here. No. It's just like this information came from nowhere. The people that got the information chose to ignore the fact that it came from somewhere. Mm-hmm. And instead made snakes and comets.
Yeah.
It's like, what are you talking about?
It doesn't make any sense when you look at it from that perspective.
So.
Yeah. And he does say in one of the episodes, he's like, I'm not saying that the ancient peoples weren't smart enough to come up with these ideas on their own.
But I am.
yeah, I know. He had some reason for why he's not saying that. But like, actually, what he did is spend 8 episodes explaining why they weren't smart enough to come up with this on their own. So it's just so dismissive of the ingenuity of ancient societies around the world. It's just insulting, really.
Yeah. One of the things I thought was interesting is at the Serpent Mound site, episode 6 mm-hmm. is what it was. I said a wrong episode earlier, but episode 6 was Poverty Point Serpent Mound.
Yeah.
It's in our own notes.
Yeah,
which
it is.
I didn't look at.
Well, there's a lot of notes. We had a lot of things to say about this show.
Right. But one of his proofs, so to speak, mm-hmm. that Serpent Mound dates back to prior to the earliest date that we have is apparently 321 BCE, mm-hmm. which I don't know how it's so specific. Usually there's an error range there, but 321.
Yeah, that is.
He didn't
specific.
Make that up. That comes from evidence.
Yeah.
There was other dating that came back about 1,000 years, and then more recent dating has come back about 321 BCE. Mm-hmm. Now, again, he's not wrong in this, but he thinks that that's a date of a reconstruction, like mm-hmm. like a refurbishment of Serpent Mound. Like
right.
People throughout the last 12,000 years have collectively said, let's take care of this thing. Mm-hmm. We can't even collectively take care of our own historic structures. But for 12,000 years, Native Americans said, let's take care of Serpent Mound.
Right.
And they didn't let trees grow on it. They didn't let anything. They kept building it up. And, you know, it's just like,
stopped it from eroding away, like maintained it. Yeah, for sure.
So there's that.
Yeah.
But then also, his reasoning for saying that this also is inherited knowledge of ancient astronomy and these building techniques and basically a lesson to the future is the head of the snake, which is eating a sun or an oval shaped structure, which is interpreted as the sun. I don't know why it would be an oval. The sun is clearly round. But anyway, it's an oval shaped structure that looks more like an egg to me.
Yeah.
Snakes eat eggs all the time. But it's oriented towards the sun at one of the solstices. Mm-hmm. Right. I think it's oriented to the west for the setting sun, but I can't remember
which one they said. Yeah.
Either way, a solstice, right?
Yeah.
So when it's oriented there, it's actually about 2 degrees off. Mm-hmm. And 2 degrees, if you're just looking at the skyline, is not that much. Mm-hmm. Like, you really need some precise measurements to know that it's 2 degrees off.
Yeah.
And so what he did, and you can actually use an app like the Starwalk app that I have on my iPhone mm-hmm. to roll back time as far as you want to go, because the position of the stars and planets and all the stuff in the sky is easily predictable back an infinite amount of time.
Right.
Because we know about it. We know where it's going to be. If you want to see what the sky looked like where you're standing right now 1,000 years ago, just roll Starwalk back. Yep. You know, it's a pretty cool thing to do.
Yeah.
And as our solar system moves through the galaxy, because we are rotating around in the Milky Way galaxy, then, and we're also bobbing up and down within the spiral arms on a sine wave, our view of the stars changes right through time. So what he did was basically said, okay, so where was the solstice? You know, because the Earth also wobbles a little bit. So where was the solstice aligned with the head of the serpent?
Right.
And he walked that back, or researchers walked that back, and it was about 10,000 years ago.
No, it was 12,800 years ago.
Oh, yeah, 10,000 BC.
Yeah.
So but I always mix that up.
I know.
But exactly fitting his theory.
Exactly fits his theory, which is so annoying that it happens to fit his theory.
And I'm like, you had to walk back 12,000 years to go 2 degrees?
Yeah.
So if they were 1 degree off 6,000 years ago, would they have noticed that?
Yeah.
If they were a half a degree off 3,000 years ago, would they have noticed that?
Mm-hmm.
And if they were less than 1.5 degrees off, or a little more than 1.5 degrees off, if we're projecting this as linear, 2,000 years ago when this was, or 2,500 years ago when this was supposedly built, would they have noticed that?
I know, like, that's such a small difference, and these people don't have sophisticated equipment. They're going on observation from a year or 2 years or 5 years before while they're building this thing, because it would have taken years probably to build the full serpent mound.
Right.
They could have waited till the end to do that one part that needed to line up properly, but like,
but we're also not saying they weren't capable of doing this.
Of course
they
were
capable of precision, but my kind of point is, things like this are built from a religious standpoint, either to give power to somebody or to give power to the deities around them, right? That's why these things are usually done. It wasn't built as a playground for the children.
Right.
So, which would be super cool, though, like a luge track in the form of a serpent. But anyway, it wasn't built for those reasons. It was built for these ceremony and spiritual reasons. So would 2 degrees even have mattered that much?
Right.
Even if they did notice it, it still gets the point across.
Right.
You know, you can't say that they would need to have been exactly 100% that precise.
Yeah.
That thinking right there is 100% flawed.
Yeah, for sure. It's still human.
Still human.
Humans are flawed. So.
Yeah. But he does say in that episode as well, this is where he mentions that archaeologists are not trained in astronomy.
Yeah.
He says astronomy is not in. Oh, he says something about astronomy being an intrusion into archaeology.
Yeah.
Astronomy is not an intrusion into archaeology. And it's a very accepted, I guess, methodology to think of astronomy when you're thinking about the orientation of prehistoric structures. Now, we don't necessarily think of astronomy when we think of teepee rings in Wyoming, right?
Not necessarily, but they might have had the opening towards a particular orientation of the sun. It's entirely possible.
I mean, you might want the opening towards the east in the morning, so you can be warmed by the sunrise.
In. Yeah, for sure.
Or more likely, you might want the opening to the east, just because in the plains of Wyoming, the wind is almost always coming from the west.
Yeah.
So maybe you don't want that blowing into your teepee. You know,
there's a lot of practical reasons that you need to consider for why people would have built things in the orientation that they did. And I will say that it is easy for archaeologists to jump to the more ritual or symbolic reasons for why people did things. But you're right. It could have been as practical as like wind blocking.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, I think one last thing, because we really need to finish up this episode, that we'll mention is kind of going back to almost one of the last episodes, like episode 8. There's the what's called the Channeled Scablands in Washington.
Yeah.
And I actually first heard about this when we went to the Walla Walla. Not Walla Walla, the Tri-Cities area in Washington and the Red Mountain Wine District.
Yeah.
And a lot of
delicious
those people.
Delicious wines, by the way.
Delicious wines. Yeah. But the reason the wine is so good right there is because of the volcanic fertile nature of the soils.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ways that is the accepted theory that area got that way is from this, the theories in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically giant Lake Missoula, which was the freshwater lake at the edge of the ice sheets, the Laurentian ice sheet in this particular case. There was two of them, the Cordillerian and the Laurentian, that covered North America. And the Lake Missoula was the freshwater outflow of the melting of that glacier, right?
Right.
And it was huge. Took up half of Western Montana.
Yeah.
If not all of Western Montana.
Right.
And when that At some point, you know, and this happens today and pretty much every river that ices over is an ice dam was created basically up in the mountains between Idaho and Montana. And that ice dam gave way and drained Lake Missoula. Mm-hmm. I mean, not drained it completely, but drained a lot of the water out of Lake Missoula. And then the theory goes that as ice was melting, the lake filled back up again. Yeah. And then, you know, more ice clogged up this hole. I just thought of something. I'll bring it up in a second. But more ice clogged up this hole. And that happened many, many times as the ice sheets were melting and receding. Right. And what that did was carved out this area and brought all this, you know, material from the mountains down into these plains, but also carved out these huge canyons. Right. Yeah. So all that's accepted. The fringe on this is that, and he brought in an amateur geologist.
It's always an amateur.
Who his title under the show is catastrophist.
Yeah. So definitely believe anything that guy says.
This guy, I think it took a few weeks. It was one event that caused this, which fits Graham Hancock's theory of cataclysmic events across the planet happening simultaneously.
Yeah. To wipe out this whole ancient people.
Right.
And then, you know, have them.
Yeah.
That's why there's no evidence left for them.
They're saying there's evidence that it happened in one shot. Yeah. Right. Now, my question is, I didn't think about this till just now. If you've got this, what would have to be a relatively small area where the ice dam was, and they're not disputing that there was an ice dam. They're just saying it happened all at once.
Yeah.
The thing I would wonder is where's that ice dam? And why wouldn't that have just been completely wiped out? If you were to manage to destroy millions of cubic yards of material in the span of a couple of weeks, what would have happened to the edge of ancient Lake Missoula? Oh, why was that intact?
Yeah, how is that still there?
Why was that? Yeah. I don't know. That's a weird thing. But.
See, there's just a lot wrong with that idea. And and I think you said that it really flies in the face of the accepted geological theory of uniformitarianism.
Right. Which is essentially says that the geological processes we see happening around us today have persisted through time.
Yeah.
Like science hasn't changed. Physics hasn't changed.
Right.
You know, geology hasn't changed.
Yeah.
There are catastrophic events. Nobody's not saying that.
Right.
But you have to prove it.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, for sure. Like volcanoes happen, earthquakes happen, and those can be catastrophic, but they wouldn't.
They're pretty obvious when they do.
But they're obvious. Yeah. We see the evidence very clearly when that happens.
Yeah.
So
I think what we're coming down to here is, you know, this show has a lot of really cool graphics. It's got a lot of really cool depictions of ancient sites. I'm really glad that it's exposing these sites, like Rachel said early on, that aren't necessarily talked about. It's not just all pyramids and Stonehenge. Yeah. It's stuff that doesn't necessarily get talked about in popular shows like this very often. And that's really, really cool.
I think that's cool.
The underground caves in Turkey.
Yeah, we didn't even really talk about those, but those were so cool. I've never even heard of those before.
It's really neat. And let me, I want to mention something about that real quick. They have the one which name I can't remember. Did we write it down?
We did. Darren Kuyu.
Yeah. So that was one of the, I guess one of the earlier ones that was found, and it could have held about 20,000 people. It was excavated in this soft ash, which was also really strong, but soft enough to carve out. It's just these underground dwellings that go down something like 80 meters.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, and then once they started looking, there's over 40 or 50 of those that go down way far. And then they said when you start to include the ones that are only one or two levels deep, there's over 200 and in this area of Turkey. And I think what I took away from that is, I mean, it's also like passed down knowledge, too. Like, you know, people are, and not passed down from an ancient civilization, passed down locally. You know, people are saying, hey, this is actually kind of a, you know, we don't have to worry about weather. We don't have to worry about stuff. We can still grow things on the surface, but then we can live down below where it's always the same temperature. It's always working out, you know. So why wouldn't other cultures do that? You see that throughout all kinds of places where people build something and other people say, that's a good idea. I'm going to do that too.
Yeah. And like, if it's already there too, why wouldn't you keep using it?
Yeah.
If you need a place to get out of the scorching sun for the summer and it already exists, great. Or maybe there's an invading army coming and you need a place to hide. Great. It's already there. Somebody built it 500 years ago. Use of it.
Look at Oregon. Portland is a pretty cool town. They got a lot of neat things. And Eugene was like, me too. So sorry, Eugene, but it's true.
Eugene is the new Portland,
right? Eugene is the new Portland, but it's not like Portland passed down that information.
No.
Eugene was just like, Portland's cool. I want that here.
I'm not really sure about your analogy, but okay, let's go with
absolutely
it.
Absolutely true. But Portland got all of its ideas from Seattle. So
oh my God.
Hashtag truth.
Oh, says the Washingtonian here. So
yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, go watch the show. Don't not watch the show.
Yeah. But be also, skeptical.
But one thing he did say that I think is actually sadly true. Now, we stop a lot of roadside, you know, signs and things like that. You see this like, oh, historical event happened here signs and things like that. One of the things he did say was true was do your own research on that stuff if you really want to know the story, because a lot of times these signs are put up by historical societies. They're put up by almost individuals. They're put up by a lot of different groups and things.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not always updated.
Yeah.
Right. They're not always updated. So if you see something and it sounds like, is that actually true? Mm-hmm. Look it up online and see if there's some other information you can find about it. You know, mm-hmm. more than likely, most of what is on the sign is true.
Yeah.
And we're not. Archaeologists aren't keeping people from updating those signs because we don't like the theories. He was implying that.
He is. Yeah. This whole, like we said, this whole thing really did feel like an attack on archaeologists and also historians and geologists to some extent, too. And that is just a little bit unfair. And I think the thing to leave you with is not only is he portraying archaeologists as the bad guys, he's portraying himself as a victim.
Mm-hmm.
And Graham Hancock is nobody's victim.
Yeah.
He like people are saying things about him because he is provoking them.
Yeah.
And he is not a victim here. So that is just ridiculous.
This is a call to all archaeologists out there that if the call comes down from a producer to do any show, I don't care what it's about. If you're going to be the lead, please do it.
Yeah.
Because we need more people to accept those sorts of positions. I've said this on many podcasts that I've done on many different shows.
Mm-hmm.
We need people like us who are into this sort of promotion and doing mm-hmm. these things to actually get on those TV shows.
Yeah.
Get on them and do them. Why does Graham Hancock have a popular 8-episode Netflix series?
I know.
Because he wanted one.
Yeah. If we don't engage, then we don't get to control the narrative or at least contribute to the narrative. You know, like we're not helping form the public mind if we're not out there, if we close off like Serpent Mound did. I'm kind of really annoyed that Serpent Mound closed their doors to Graham Hancock and wouldn't let him film there because they didn't think it was going to support their narrative. Well, no, of course it wasn't. But if you don't engage in the conversation, then how can you have a voice in it? You lose the ability to have a voice, which is, I don't think, was the right move personally.
Well, we're taking our voice and eating some leftover turkey right now. So,
yeah, totally.
With that, let's have your opinions. Feel free to email Chris at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Mm-hmm. And I want to hear what you have to think about this.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. All right. We'll see you next time.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ArcPodNet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. Please consider leaving a review on your favorite podcasting app. You could also consider becoming a member so we can keep content like this free and available to all. Check out pricing and info at arcpodnet.com/members. Thanks again and have a great day.